We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Darius Miller.
This is Drew Hardy.
This is Lance Thomas, Tyree Gavin.
Jason Smith.
Anthony Davis of the Wolves Pelicans.
You're listening to.
And you are listening to In the Know.
In the Know.
The Bourbon Street Shots.
Bourbon Street Shots podcast.
All Pelicans, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Since our last podcast, the Pelicans have gone 1-1. Having a slugfest in Boston. And a loss pretty predictable to Indiana. Michael, when Ryan Anderson went down, how many screams of anger filled your house?
I don't know. It was a weird situation because, I mean, it wasn't one of those injuries that looked bad, really, even upon replay. The guy who he basically gets in a collision with gets right up. You even see movement from Ryan Anderson after the two collided. So, you know, I just thought it was something where he was trying to catch his breath or, you know, when it first happened, I didn't really think anything of it. Then he stayed there a little longer. I still thought he was trying to catch his breath. And then minutes go by and you hear the stretchers coming out. And it's just, it was more of a tough thing to process than being angry. I think I reserved the anger for after the win, which is, you know, I commented right afterwards that, This is one of the only teams that I leave angry after wins. I mean, this is Anthony Davis gets hurt in that Knicks game. The Pelicans get a win and still couldn't find any joy in that. And it was the same with this game just because, you know, really at that point had no information on what was going on with Ryan Anderson and in a lot of ways still don't.
Yeah, there's been no updates, which, I mean, I wish we had something to look at, even if it's tests are ongoing. But, I mean, I guess no news is good news?
I don't know. I go back and forth on this. I want to hear your thinking. So, I mean, this was, let's see, the Boston game was what, Friday night?
Yeah.
Yes, it was Friday night.
And then they had to travel. So
He stayed in the Boston hospital. He's been there. He's had Pelicans people stay with him, so he's been there. It's been about 48 hours now and really no updates. So your gut feeling is the no news good news, or are you bracing for something significant?
I actually think it's going to be one of those niggling injuries that you're never really sure when he's going to come back from. But I don't think it's anything serious. So week or two, maybe, at most. I mean, it's one of those things, though, that always does terrify me because it's the back. He got hit in the back. And we've seen players have, once their back starts going a little bit, it goes out repeatedly or seriously. We got it with they have it with Okafor right now. We've seen Davis on this team, Baron Davis, of course. Then of course Peja Stojakovic more recently. I don't know. I hate back injuries.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I go,
brought up all the worst case scenarios for you, didn't I?
No, I mean, I'm not as worried in that regard. First of all, those were more athletic players. And secondly, the best case scenario here is it is just a stinger, and it's not something where he'll be any more likely, you know, to have reoccurring issues than somebody who hasn't had a stinger. So, I don't know. I go back and forth. The optimistic side says if they went in and saw the x-rays and something was really, really, really wrong, they would know right away. And, you know, we would have an update and they would be going into surgery or preparing for it, whatever. So the fact that they continue to do more tests and there's no word leads me to believe that, you know, they didn't find anything, and now they're just double, triple, quadruple checking so that way they don't miss anything. And then, you know, the other side, the dark side of my mind goes, well, maybe they found something and they're just exploring the two options where one would be some kind of surgery that would, you know, mean he would miss the year. And then the other option would be trying to rehabilitate and see if he can make it stronger without surgery. So that, to me, those are the only two options. I mean, he's in a great, I mean, obviously could pay for the best doctors, as numerous doctors. He's in a great facility. It's hard for me to believe that they have no idea what's going on. Those are the two options for me. Either they don't see anything, but they want to check and make sure, or they see something that is either surgery or, you know, something that could be surgery or maybe rehabilitated, and they're testing that out.
Yeah. I will say this. Cervical stingers there is no surgery option for that. So if it actually is a cervical stinger, if that's what he's got, surgery's off the table. It's just rehab and wait till it feels better.
Yeah, so. I mean, and then the negative side of that is a lot of times injuries are first diagnosed as cervical stingers and they wind up being herniated discs.
Yeah, we never seen that before.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess following this team, I am definitely, you know, brushing up on my WebMD. Like, I'm learning a lot more about the body. Like, I didn't know about metatarsals and, you know, now the cervical stinger, like, I mean, that is the one positive of following this team, is I do learn a lot more about the body and injuries and rehab times by all the different random injuries that these guys get.
Yeah, I'll be honest. When I heard cervical stinger, I was thinking of a different body part than the neck. I had to go look and make sure they were saying that correctly.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't think Ryan Anderson had one of those. But no, I was wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, I mean, it's going to hugely impact this team. Like I said, I basically wrote off Indiana and Miami as losses. So if he misses those, I'm fine. I said the big stretch is going to start January 8th. And, you know, some of the teams are coming back to the pack. Eric Bledsoe's hurt for Phoenix. Dallas has lost a couple games now. Minnesota lost. I'm surprised this game wasn't more talked about. Kevin Love basically missed four free throws down the stretch. They lost a heartbreaker the other night. You know, teams are starting to come back to the pack. Even the Clippers with CP3's injury, you figure they're going to lose a bunch of games. Unfortunately, we don't get the Clippers or the Thunder with CP3 and Russell out. Of course, we can't catch a break like that. But, I mean, playoff spot is going to be there for the taking. If Ryan Anderson misses significant time, or worst case scenario, he misses the year, I mean, I firmly believe you can't lose Ryan Anderson or Anthony Davis from this team for a stretch of time and expect any kind of success.
I agree with that. And you could see it in both these two games. I mean, Anderson goes down, and I'm not sure the Pelicans had more than one three-pointer the rest of that game. Attempt. I'm not even talking about hits, just attempts.
Yeah.
And, you know, against the Pacers, which, I mean, they're admittedly a very good defensive team, but, I mean, we only took 9 3-pointers. It's this team cannot survive in the modern NBA attempting 9 3-pointers in a game.
Yeah, I mean, the only way you can is if you have a stellar defense. Like last year's Memphis Grizzlies could thrive, could succeed. They could thrive with it if you just have, you know, or even what the Pacers are playing this year. They hit threes also, but I'm saying even if they didn't, they would. This Pelicans team, they can't both have a terrible defense and not be able to hit 3-pointers. I mean, it's just, it's not going to work. So let's start off with that Boston game. I mean, to me, it was a weird game in a couple of ways. I won't tell you what I thought was weird. I want to get, I guess, your viewpoint on the game overall and then maybe some specifics first.
What I thought was weird was how odd the Boston Celtics are as a team. They have basically a backcourt filled with athletic freaks and lumbering muscles in the front court that can't really, they have no athletic ability whatsoever, but they can bowl their way to anything. It's like basically someone took a team and said, I want 2 or 3 Zach Randolphs at the front, and then a whole bunch of Eric Bledsoe-type players. It's a weird group.
Now, do you think Bass and Sulliger are that powerful on, you know, in a vacuum, or do you think they look that way going against our, you know, weak and skinny and small front line?
Well, I think it's the comparison, absolutely. I mean, Sulliger is huge. I mean, he was huge in college. He continues to be huge. And the guy is going to just, that is what he has to do to stay in the NBA is bowl his way around the hoop. Bass, seeing him dominate anything on the inside is kind of surprising because Brandon Bass was a finesse player. He's kind of always been a finesse player. So convincing him to be something other than that or actually seeing him act that way is kind of weird. I mean, his highest rebound rate his entire career were the 2 years he played in New Orleans at 15%. And everything since then has been right around 12%, which if you know anything about rebound rates, 12% is like small forward, a good small forward, but really bad for power forward and center.
Yeah. I mean,
and Torres hit, what, 12 rebounds? Was it 11 rebounds that game?
Yeah,
11.
I think those guys are, maybe they're bigger than the, I don't know. I don't see them doing that against many teams. I mean, those two and Chris Humphreys. The three of them combined for 21 offensive rebounds against the Pelicans. I mean, they're all 6'8", 6'9", 6'10". Yeah, they have a little bulk, but those three guys shouldn't be grabbing 21 offensive rebounds against anybody. And they just, I mean, there were times they would just, I remember Brandon Bass just catching the ball about 15 feet out, driving the ball straight into Steemsma's chest. Teamsman goes flying back, you know, 5-6 feet, and Bass just has an easy layup. I mean, I highly doubt, I haven't watched many Celtics games because I actually value my time, but I highly doubt that those guys are doing that against, you know, not even great, but average front lines in the NBA. And it just, you know, coming off of that Minnesota game where Love and Pekovic just absolutely bullied our interior. I knew that the Celtics would do some of that, but I didn't think that those three guys would have those type of performances.
Yeah. Well, Celtics have been a good rebounding team all year. Of course, it does help that they missed 58 shots. When you miss 58 shots, 22 offensive rebounds, it's still a big number. It's 37%, which is a high offensive rebound rate, but it does put it into a little bit of perspective. They could not hit a thing. It was ridiculous how many, you know, just point-blank shots they completely blew.
Yeah, I don't know. I, especially watching the first half of the Pacers game that next night, I mean, at least to me, the two things that stood out the most were, I mean, just the Pelicans in general seemed to have almost no energy in this game. I mean, if you put this game tape on versus what you saw in the first half of the Pacers game, it makes you really wonder if this team plays up and down to competition. And then the second thing that was so curious to me, I mean, eventually the minutes evened out, but in the first half, Tyreek, Gordon, and Holiday all got somewhere between 10 and 13 minutes. And, you know, people who were commenting on the boards or on Twitter were saying, Monty is just is trying to limit the minutes to save guys for the next night in Indiana, knowing that he has this victory in the bag. I don't believe it. I think that was, you know, fan concocted, but the rotations were very weird. And if that is true, I mean, to me, I couldn't think of a dumber strategy. You step on people's throats and you take the wins you could get. You would never look forward to the next game. I mean, if that's not the reason, what can you explain being the reason why those guys got such limited minutes in the first half?
Why do you always give me the crap jobs of explaining this stuff?
Because I can't figure it out. Where do I get the Eric Gordon in the Indiana game?
I mean, I was sitting there fuming on my couch. Tyreek Evans hadn't gone in yet, and I think there's 4 minutes left in the first quarter. But Evans should be getting starters' minutes, and he ended with 29, which isn't awful. I mean, I'd only want 3 or 4 more, really, but I can't explain it. I don't understand what he's thinking. I don't understand if he's just trying out different things, and I don't know.
All right. Yeah.
It would be different if, you know, I can see having Evans sitting on the bench if Eric Gordon's playing really well. If he's like tearing the place apart, yeah, Evans, you can sit there for a little while longer. But Eric Gordon wasn't tearing anything apart. So I'm flabbergasted. I don't have an answer for you. I'm not going to do the defend Brian Roberts thing here.
No, and I mean, the minutes did even out, one, because Ryan Anderson got hurt. So,
right.
But the first half, like I said, I think it was 12 minutes for Evans, 13 for Gordon, and 10 for Holiday. I mean, there was an 11-minute stretch, and Jrue Holiday wasn't in foul trouble. There was 11 consecutive minutes in the first half where Jrue Holiday was not in the game. Do you think there's any chance that that was part of Monty's strategy, what some people suggested, that he was going to try to limit the minutes against a bad team, hopes of keeping them fresh against Indiana?
No, because wins, they all count the same. It doesn't matter if you beat Boston or you beat Indiana Pacers. If you're going in there, take the win you think you can get, and then hope you can take the win you don't think you can get. That wouldn't make any sense to me.
I completely agree.
What do you think of a Jenkins starter?
I mean, I guess it's somewhat matchup dependent. If he's a starter, he's one of the worst three starting centers in the NBA.
Of course, we were starting Steamsma at the beginning of the season, and wouldn't you have said the same thing?
This is what I'm saying, is it's about the bar that these guys are leaping over. And really, we're talking about...
Wait, you think they're actually leaping over the bar?
That's what I'm saying. It's so low that maybe they're just stepping over it, but...
I think they're tripping over
it. Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure people are looking at the box score if they didn't see this game, and it looks like Steamsma had, you know, an amazing game, 6 or 7 for 12 points, but really, he just got a couple of dump downs under the basket that he had to lay up, which... You know, actually, I shouldn't poo-poo, because the next night in Indiana, he missed a point-blank layup after a dish from Tyreek. So him going 6 for 7 actually really helped in this game. But
he had a mid-range shot.
Yeah, that's right. And Ajinka hit 3 the next night. But no, I mean, we could sit here and debate. But the truth is that guys like that, pretty much guys 8 through 15 on our team shouldn't really be playing for a team that have aspirations of making the playoffs. I understand that you're going to have injuries and you need people to step in from time to time, but I mean, really debating Ajinka versus Steamsma versus, you know, Lou Amundsen when he was here, or whatever guy we're going to send to a 10-day contract next. You know, it really doesn't matter. It's going to come down to the core you know, five guys plus Amino and Smith. Smith, if he could get healthy, and then everybody else just has to not mess it up.
Yeah. So our good the most frustrating part for me about this game was I had a friend come over to watch it, and Brian Roberts and Steens would go out on the floor, and I'm like, hey, look at this. They're putting those two guys in together. This is going to end well. And immediately, like, Brian Roberts hits two shots, and he finds Steenson for a layup. I mean, do you have any faith? Because last year we saw Brian Roberts. He was not good, but he wasn't awful like he's been for most of the season. Do you have any faith that Brian Roberts has just had, like, a bad couple months, and he could bounce back and be a helpful point guard?
I mean, the only thing he can really help you with is scoring. I mean, he's not going to help you anywhere else. He's going to be a negative everywhere else. So do I think that he could hit, you know, a good amount of his shots? Yeah, I mean, I think in certain situations teams could forget about him, and he definitely could hit some jump shots. It's just that he needs to hit a good percentage of them to make up for where he's going to, you know, essentially hurt your team, either with the turnovers that, you know, are bound to come in every game, or the, I would say, the below average defense and awareness. So if he makes his jumpers, which he's capable of, he could be a slight plus, or, you know, not a negative at the very least, but he basically has to hit his jumpers in order to provide any kind of positive impact, because he's not going to really make it elsewhere.
So, Avery Bradley, the best defender in the league, or the almost best defender in the league?
I mean, I wouldn't put him at best, just because I don't think he could cover, like, I've seen LeBron cover a 1, 2, 3. And
all right, let me change that. At his position.
What's his position? Because I don't know what it is. I guess he's a
point guard.
Is he?
I would call him point guard.
Definitely,
yeah.
Point guard.
I mean, if I had to just have one guy on my team at point guard for a defensive possession, I'd probably take Avery Bradley.
Yeah, he would be. I mean, I think it would be between him, Bledsoe, and Patrick Beverley. Those would be the three guys that I've seen that I just think terrorize ball handlers.
I mean, Drew could not get comfortable in that game at all.
Yeah.
And it was because Avery was just every time. Did you notice that every time Drew stepped off the court, Avery Bradley stepped off the court?
Yeah. I mean, Brad Stevens is a smart guy, and Bradley doesn't usually give you this on offense.
No.
Also at night, but he was, you know, he definitely brought the Celtics back into that game and actually put him ahead, was hitting his threes that night. But yeah, I mean, he's a terror. I'm interested to see what his future is, because he's going to be a restricted free agent soon. I don't know. I don't know if he could be, you know, a starter on a really good team. I don't even know if he has a clearly defined position. But, man, guys like that, you know, on the right team as an X factor could just be so incredibly valuable.
Yep. And I only have one more question for you about the Boston Celtics. I think I remember talking about how I wanted Jared Sullinger to be drafted by the Pelicans.
Uh-huh.
And last year he had the issue with his back and went out for surgery, and he's back now playing. He's played all the season. Austin Rivers or Jared Sullinger?
Hmm. Those are my only two. Yeah, see, if I could go...
They were both available then. I mean, Sullinger slipped quite a ways.
Yeah.
You can't blame the Pelicans, because 21 teams, I think he was picked 22nd, 21 teams were scared off by what was being reported about him.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who was top five when that college season kicked off.
Yeah, I think his play, though, brought him down a little bit as well.
A little bit.
I mean, he did go.
Jeff Withey made him look terrible.
Yeah, he's definitely a guy that struggles with height. He's going to have to continue to develop his mid-range and his three-point shot in order to score consistently in this league, because he got a ton of offensive rebounds, but it almost didn't matter. He really couldn't go back up with it.
It's not often you see a guy get 9 offensive rebounds and he makes 3 shots.
Right. Yeah. I mean, usually if that's the case, it's because the guy's tipping the ball out and getting offensive rebound credit for that. But yeah, he wasn't doing that in this game. I mean, I guess I would take Sullinger just because bigs are always more valuable. Like I know I could trade him. But I don't know. I don't know if Austin Rivers ever really gets the chance with the Pelicans just because of the way the roster is set up. But I still would give a slight edge to Austin Rivers having a better career. I don't know if it'll be here, but I just think he has a better career. I don't think Jared Sullinger's career really lasts. You know, I think he'll always have issues in a sense. He'll fade away. He'll be kind of like DeJuan Blair, start off hot and then start having issues and, you know, kind of fade away, have his moments every now and then. But I still see more of a chance of Austin Rivers having a 10-12 year career in which he's a solid role player, where I just don't believe that Sullinger plays, you know, 800-900 games over the course of his career.
Okay. Anything else you want to talk about this game other than moaning about the rebounds?
Yeah, the rotations were really weird. That was just the thing that really stood out to me after this game. You know, I know Avery Bradley was a big part of it, but it was hard not to think of that Portland game. And, you know, you and I had the conversation of course, this team is better with Eric Gordon than Roberts and Anthony Morrow. But, you know, yes, Avery Bradley was on him, and yes, he had a decent defender on him the next night and George Hill. But this is just a completely different Drew Holiday when Eric Gordon is on the team than when he's not. And it's less aggressive. This game made me go back and look at the numbers. And I was just startled the difference in Holiday. You know, the Pelicans, the team, is better just statistically with Gordon on the bench than on the court, you know. But that's one thing. When I looked at the difference in Holiday's numbers with Gordon and without him, it was staggering to me, and it was something that the eye test told me first and then the numbers backed up. But he's just not the same type of player. In the last podcast, you asked me, why doesn't he shoot more threes, or, you know, why isn't he more aggressive? I'm not saying it's Eric Gordon's fault, but I am saying it just, the eye test tells me and the numbers back me up that he plays completely different with Eric Gordon than without him.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he looks for Eric Gordon, and I think he's very clearly thinking Eric Gordon is our go-to scorer in a lot of situations, and he doesn't think that he should be the guard doing it.
Do you think that there's too much... I wouldn't know how to say it. There's like too much order in our offensive sets. I watch a lot of other NBA teams, and it seems like the good offensive teams are just more free-flowing. I mean, especially when you have a lot of the weapons, there's all these, you know, dribble handoffs, and it seems like our sets have all this motion that really goes nowhere and takes like 12 seconds to set up. And I don't know. To me, like in that Portland game when they were just going and attacking, and, you know, it wasn't. I mean, we have that one set where it's like three dribble handoffs at the top of the key that takes 10 seconds, where each of the guards drives and dribble hands off to the other, and then finally we have one isolated at the top. Like, I don't know. It seems to me like the really great offenses, they play with a kind of disorder, where everything seems so ordered in our offense that I know the numbers are looking good this year, but it still doesn't feel like they have that explosive capability that you see in really great offenses.
I agree with you, and there are plays that sometimes I'm like, I end up sitting there saying, what was that? What was the point of that? And I know half the time it's like they're hoping that the defender will trail instead of jump, and then they'll get a clear lane somewhere, and it doesn't happen, so they then move on to the next thing. But I will say that neither of our guards that start, and that includes Holiday, really like to force the issue. And that's why Tyreek Evans is so vital to this team's offense, is he is chaos. He doesn't care if you're standing in front of you. He's going to do some sort of funky dribble, get around you, and then try to lay it up. Drew Holiday, if you're there, he might take a jumper over you, but he's not going to force it by trying to drive to the basket and do some sort of creativity. And Eric Gordon, I think Eric Gordon is really the type of basketball player who catches the ball and he just decides I'm doing A or B, and it doesn't really necessarily matter what people are doing around him. He's only got one thing that he does that I think is in response to what the defense is doing, and that's when if he's dribbling along the three-point line, coming out towards the top, frequently if he sees a gap, he'll cut to the basket really quick there, and it's a great move when he does it. I mean, it usually works really well. But otherwise, I think he really does make a decision almost before he's caught the ball that, well, this time I'm shooting, I'm going to take a couple dribbles and shoot, or this time I'm going to drive. And it doesn't matter what happens elsewhere. And that's you know, limiting.
Yeah. I don't know. The numbers still say that they're a top six offense, but
right.
Like I said, I don't feel like the Pacers, which we'll talk about now, they went on 18-0 run. I don't think it's possible we see a run like that from the Pelicans. There's just not that type of explosiveness and randomness to them. It's almost too composed and orderly. So moving on to that Pacers game, I thought almost in a way that opening night, I thought that first half against the Pacers was one of the best halves of basketball I had seen. They did blow a couple of opportunities in that second quarter. You started to see that, you know, it was kind of fool's gold, just missing opportunities here and there. I thought the Pacers first half was really sloppy, and the Pelicans, I felt that lead at halftime should have been closer to 12. I mean, Drew Holiday steps up to the line and bricks two free throws. No clue what's going on there. Just a couple of sloppy turnovers, seems like multiple traveling violations. The Pelicans have been having palming violations lately. Yeah. We had a 5-second call not too long. I mean, like, this team turns the ball over in really odd ways. But, Gordon was really hot, 17 points in the first half. Ajenka was hitting some mid-range jumpers, getting to the free throw line. I thought they were doing a decent job. I thought the funniest thing was, that the number one thing Monty talked to them about was defensive rebounding. All five guys would just slam into the paint off any Pacers shot, which actually hurt a little bit sometimes because the ball would bounce out long and there were no Pelicans there because they were all in the paint. But I thought it was a really good, highly energetic first half, one that they should have, you know, possibly led by a little more, but this is on the road against one of the best teams in the NBA. I thought for the second time in a row, they played a really good first half against them.
Yeah, I enjoyed the first half tremendously, but I will say it just felt like in the third quarter, the Pacers went back to their locker room and the coach probably walked out and said, "Are we, guys, seriously? Are we not going to lock in this game at all?" And they came in and they locked in long enough that they needed to. I mean, their defense, it funnels everybody exactly where they want them to go at all times. And the Pelicans went the way that they were directed to, and ended up with not the greatest shots in the world. A lot of, you know, mid-range jump shots.
What do you think of the Pacers' offense? Do you think it's a good offense, an average offense, a bad offense?
I would be hard pressed to call it good. It's fine. It's good enough with their defense. I don't think Paul George is a brilliant offensive player. I think that he's gotten that like reputation now, that he's, you know, on the same level as Durant and LeBron. And you can't really say that. I don't think he's brilliant as a ball handler, but as a second attacker, he's very good. So if he can come off of somebody feeding him the ball and then attack the basket or take a shot, I think he's a lot more capable. But I mean, even like just look at their team in general. If you take a look at any of those guys' careers, they're the big scorers on the team is Paul George, who's never been a super efficient scorer. This is his most efficient ever this year. David West, even at his best, was never a super efficient scorer. Hibbert's never been a super efficient scorer. Stevenson is just coming into his own, but he's always been an erratic player. And George Hill's always been okay. So you got a starting five that they're all okay. And it's not too far from what like we have with Jrue Holiday. Jrue Holiday, honestly, he's not that efficient of a scorer. If he's the one taking your shots, overall, you're not going to be, you know, an amazing efficient team. But he's got guys around him who could finish at high efficiency, especially when Anderson's on the floor, which makes things change. But the Pacers don't have that. And they're still dangerous because their defense is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and we were making the shots that, you know, they were given in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Third quarter seems like a lot of fans, obviously, the Pelicans players and coaches had some problems with it too, with the Pelicans getting into the lane and feeling like they were fouled and should have been sent to the line. Numerous technicals were picked off because the Pelicans coaching staff and players went kind of crazy on the refs. And then, of course, miraculously, the free throw attempts start to come. I guess my first question to you, those first couple minutes in the third quarter, did you feel like maybe Indiana was getting the benefit of some calls and we weren't getting the benefit of whistles that we might have deserved?
I think when you watch Indiana, Hibbert is frustrating because he is physical and it feels like he fouls people a lot. Same with George, but more Hibbert, in my opinion. But Hibbert has mastered one essential skill that always seems to be really difficult for most centers to figure out. And that's just if you keep your hands straight up so that at no point, even if you get hit in the stomach, your arms come down a little bit, they're not going to actually call the contact you do with your lower body. If you watch like Ajinka or Steamsland, somebody drives the ball into their bodies, they always inevitably hack down with their hands. And part of it's just physics. You get hit in your stomach, your hands come down. That's how your body moves. And Hibbert's figured out how not to do it. So I don't actually think that the Pacers had like some unfair advantage with the refs. I think that's just what happens when you play Hibbert because he's figured out how to play the refs the right way.
So here's the second part to my question then. After the Pelicans get those technicals,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden their free throw attempts go skyrocketing. Now, do you think that if teams, players, coaches work the referees, that it has a significant impact on referees? Do you think that that's something that perhaps the Pelicans need to do more?
They probably need to do more because I think it definitely has an impact with some referees. There are some referees, you start talking to them and they're just going to get pissed at you. Danny Crawford comes to mind. But there are some referees who they try to be reasonable out there. If you're calling and you're saying, they're doing this to me, they're doing this to me, they're doing this to me all the time, inevitably they're going to look for that to see if you're full of it or not. And you might get the benefit of fewer doubts because they're doing some more scrutiny of that particular thing. I don't think you could just sit there and say, they're fouling me. You have to actually say, well, he's holding my arm on this play every single time. And they might call it when you run over the screen and the guy grabs your elbow. But yeah, I mean, I do think it helps. And there's a reason why Chris Paul spends every dead ball standing next to a ref if he's not next to his coach and he's talking to the ref.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, not that anybody wants to hear my tales of high school basketball coaching, but I would say it's one of the things that I've I've learned the most now in my second year. My first year, I thought, you know, be respectful and nice to the refs. They're going to be on my side, give me the benefit of the doubt. I was more nice talk and just, you know, shake hands afterwards, have my kids be nice to them, whatever. And just time after time, I would watch opposing coaches just rant and rave and go ballistic. And, you know, I thought, you know, these kids' parents are in the stands and these guys are taking it like it's game seven of the finals. Calm down. But time and time again, it just seemed to work. And at some point, you know, I was wondering if I was doing damage to my own team by not doing it. I mean, it's just my personal experience with it, but it does seem to have an effect. And just psychologically, you could understand it as a human being. You don't want somebody continually yelling at you and berating you, you know, throughout a game. I fully get it. And it's a critique that people seem to have of Monty, that they, you know, they want him to get more animated, not just in this situation, but in other situations, and occasionally take a technical for the team. I don't know. I think there are some unfair criticisms of Monty. I think that might be a fair one, and one that, you know, I mean, he comes from a spirited guy like Popovich. McMillan wasn't as spirited, but I would think that he would have learned something as an assistant coach. And I tend to fall in line that he has to be, you know, a little bit more adamant. If anything else, it just allows the players to know that you have their back. And I don't think there's any conspiracy theories that I believe in, but this team doesn't seem to ever get the benefit of the calls. I leave a game going, man, we might have got screwed over on that one. I sometimes leave a game going, yeah, that was about 50-50, or not even think about the refs. I never, ever leave a game going, man, we really got the benefit of some calls tonight.
Yeah, though I don't know how much that is just personal bias anyways. I don't think I can ever remember. Very rarely do I remember going away from a game thinking that.
Oh, not true. With Chris Paul, I always felt that way.
I guess that's true. Chris Paul was a great flopper.
He was a great flopper. He worked the refs. I honestly can't wait until other teams get mad and accuse refs of having bias towards us. And I'll gladly take those wins where, you know, where we have the benefit of the doubt on our side. So I don't know. There's something to it. I still believe that a lot of it goes on the players, like you said, defensively. I also notice even our wing players, especially Aminu and Tyreek, there was times in this game where a guard would drive into them and take a bad shot, like a 10-foot, you know, runner or floater. And they would, instead of just putting their arms straight up, they would swipe down and try to go for the steal as that guard was bringing the ball up. And almost every time, it was a foul. And I just, you know, what's the point? I mean, how many times do you actually get that ball clean? And even if you do get it clean, the refs, you know, don't call you for a foul. I don't know. It's just so many small things. I don't think it's on the refs nearly as much. If I were to make a pie chart, it would be 85% just our players simply doing dumb, basically young guy things.
Yeah, and I don't know if you're going to be able to get away from that until they get a little older and start figuring stuff out and figure out on their own. I mean, these guys got to figure out on their own at some point.
Yeah.
How to defend somebody.
Yeah, I mean, in watching it, hopefully they learned some things against a team like Indiana. So you said you don't want me to ask tough questions. Too bad. I'm going to do it. Eric Gordon comes out looking like, okay, you know, it's like he was almost telling us, yeah, I wasn't really 100% in those last couple of games. Here I am, 100%, back in my home state, 17 points in the first half, three-pointers, you know, looking beautiful, driving to the basket, you know, going up in a crowd, scoring. I'm back, 17 points, 2 assists, come out third and fourth quarter, pretty much nowhere to be found. 4 points, no assists, couple turnovers. Why? I mean, what happens? I honestly don't even have a hypothesis, so I want you to maybe help me see something I don't.
The only thing that I noticed in that game was it seemed to me, they kept Lance Stephenson on him.
Uh-huh.
But it seemed to me that Paul George was shading towards him whenever he could off of Aminu in that third quarter. That George would take the extra step to try to bump Gordon a little more often, because I think a lot of what Gordon was doing in that first half was he was just moving so well. He caught the ball in places where he could attack and step into things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were making a determined effort to say, you want to fly around a screen against the Pacers, meet elbow. And even if we're not going to elbow you hard enough that a foul is going to call, you're going to stumble a little bit. You're not going to come flying off as much. And I think George kept dropping down on him when he came under the basket. So that's the only thing I can say. It wasn't like they did some grand scheme of all right, Paul George, you take him, and then he hounded him into all kinds of not being able to catch. They just basically shifted their offense a little that way, or their defense a little that way, and the Pelicans weren't able to take advantage of it. And part of that's because they're playing players like Ajinka and Al-Farouq.
Okay, I mean,
Ajinka scored, but I mean, he wasn't creating those shots himself.
So the only hope we have in the future of Eric Gordon playing like a $15 million player is if we surround him with four other really good offensive players and other teams don't make an adjustment. I mean,
no, I think your team has to realize when they're focusing on him and let somebody else create. I mean, they weren't trying to. I mean, Jrue Holiday wasn't suddenly taking over the game. I guess he did try. Because for a little while there, he got a couple turnovers. What you really need to do is have your big five in there, or you have someone like Anderson in there who can actually make them pay if you cheat off a little bit.
Yeah. Now, I mean, this is the second straight time we didn't get to see Anderson against Indiana. I mean, it's kind of funny. Anthony Davis, both times he was supposed to go back to Chicago, he gets hurt the game before.
Yeah.
And both times Ryan Anderson's supposed to play Indianapolis this year, or Indiana this year, he gets injured the day before.
Mm-hmm.
I guess those guys just don't like Midwest teams. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how this team is going to be able to score consistently. I mean, Gordon did have three beautiful three-pointers that he just stepped into in the first half. But, I mean, other than that, he goes 3 for 3 in the first half. Other than that, this team is 0 for 6. Holiday takes one. Aminu takes one. And Tyreek takes one, which nobody wants. But, I mean, to me, if I'm a defensive team, not even a great defensive team like Indiana, but just a defensive team in general, this team seems so easy for me to defend. And that's crazy when we have, you know, theoretically four guys who, if they're the focal points of their teams, could probably score, you know, average 20 points a game over a season. But, you know, a lot of the skills overlap and there's really no way to stretch it out. Without Ryan Anderson, I just don't think this is any better than, you know, maybe a 14th or 15th rated offense. I think it's a very average offense without him.
Yeah, I think we saw that at the beginning of the season. They didn't have a top 10 offense until Ryan Anderson came back. And like I said, it's very hard. They took 15 three-pointers in Boston and Indiana combined. That's the average of 20. That's worse than the average of 27 teams in one game.
Yeah, it's going to be a struggle. I mean, I really don't know what the answer is. Like I said, those are the two guys. I don't think that the Pelicans could lose, and I don't even know if they could beat, you know, average to below average teams. I mean, it was a struggle. I think Boston right now is one of the four or five worst teams in the NBA, and that was a struggle. I mean, it seems like the offense pretty much is going to center around Tyreke Evans getting to the basket, and you hope it's one of the days where he's making the shots around the rim. And on those days, maybe this team could score 100, but I think it's going to be pretty tough.
Yeah. I mean, there's also – the one thing I do want to say, though, is I think us picking out Gordon in the Indiana games is not fair because, honestly, my opinion of who lost that game for us – well, the bench was bad, but if I had to pick one starter to say he had a bad game, I'm picking Holiday. Two games in a row, Holiday has not been able to handle the pressure of skilled defenders and not been able to get it done.
Yeah, and again...
And you can't have that. You can have that if two other people on your starting five are firing. The Pelicans had one other guy firing. Davis didn't have a great game. David West worked him over and made him work really hard to get his positions, and he missed some shots he normally would have made. But you can't have, if you have a big three and you're starting five or your scorers, you can't have him shooting like this.
I agree. I don't know if Holiday knows what his role is, and I don't blame him. He goes into that starting lineup, and I know Monty, you know, just pounds into his head, you're a point guard, you got to set up others. Well, I mean, if on Anthony Davis's roles, there's two guys there, how's he going to set up Anthony Davis? Eric Gordon is, I mean, really, he's not a guy that could be set up. Every once in a while, you could find him for an open three, and he did that in the first half. I mean, at one point in this game, Holiday was 4 of 5. He actually, you know, hit a couple shots in a row in the second quarter. He took George Hill down to the post in the second quarter, got 2 free throws, which he missed. But, I mean, he was 4 of 5 early on. He missed his last 4 shots and had a couple of turnovers in that third quarter. But what is his role? Because to me, if he didn't have the label of quote-unquote point guard, he would be the scorer in the starting lineup. Instead, he's trying to facilitate, and he's facilitating for two guys who are horrible offensive players, another guy who's very limited in his offense, and then a third guy who's probably best as a scorer with the ball in his hands, not creating for him. So really, what's his role in that starting lineup?
I mean, he's got to just do a my your turn, my turn kind of thing. I mean, honestly, that's kind of what you have to do unless you're going to just have Eric Gordon run off of picks all the time. And I don't think Eric Gordon's built to do that.
Right. And I don't think Holiday's a great – I think if Morrow is in this game, maybe Holiday does play horror. I mean, I thought in the first half he went right at Hill, and he looked fantastic. But I think if Gordon isn't in this game – or, you know, I see Holiday and Evans play your turn, my turn. But it's just a weird combination right now with Gordon. It seems like he's just a more passive player. They pass the ball around. They run these sets that take forever. And then before you know it, there's 6 seconds on the clock and one of them has to go and do something stupid. I mean, it just doesn't really – that starting lineup is just you're holding on praying that they don't get blown out for when Tyreek comes in or, you know, Ryan Anderson comes in and they have some kind of semblance of a real team.
Well, I keep waiting for you to bring it up. I mean, what were you saying at the beginning of this year when they were starting Steemsma and Aminu in the starting lineup?
You can't have two black holes.
And what's the difference between Aminu and Ajinka?
There is none. I mean, in this game, he made a couple jumpers. And, of course, people jump out to now that he could be the starter, forgetting the last 3 games. But that was just an aberration. I mean, it's not going to happen consistently. It is. It's a lineup with two black holes. And as great as Anthony Davis is, he is very limited in his offensive game. He could roll to the basket. He could sometimes hit the mid-range shot, and he could face up and drive left and only left. I don't know how teams haven't learned this yet, but he only drives left off that face-up. So it's a, you know, so he basically is the point guard of a team with two black holes, a very limited offensive big man, and then a guard that, you know, has to massage the ball for 15 seconds before he drives it or shoots it. It's not exactly like he could get into the lane and kick and, you know, is surrounded by offensive players. I think his role in that lineup should be a scorer, but I know that Monty's, you know, not going to let him do that. He wants him to be a point guard. And I don't think that happens in that lineup. And that's why I think it's no coincidence that he's so much better when he's not on the court with Eric Gordon.
Yeah, I mean, this team is still facing the same problem it has at the very beginning, which is they have, on their entire roster, three usable big men. And this season, they've almost never, I think what, they had all three of them available for one or two games. So they're always filling in with completely replacement level players or worse for significant minutes. I mean, we're not talking like they're doing it for 10 minutes. This game, Ajinka plays 32 minutes. Steamsman plays 21 minutes. Withy gets 4 minutes. I mean, all, that's a lot of time out there where you have a guy who you just look at their production. Their production is replacement level, which means you could go get any ordinary jack out of the D League, bring him in here, and he's probably going to give you about the same production.
Yeah, I mean, those three combined this year have about 500 minutes played. Mm-hmm. Amundsen, Ajinka, and Steamsma, and yeah, I mean, right. Really not going
to... It's hard to get away from it, so...
Yeah, yeah.
One day, it would be nice if, you know, we could actually see a few games with Ryan Anderson, Anthony Davis, Jason Smith, and then we could have those guys be limited to the 10 minutes a game which you can swallow.
Yeah, or even less. I mean, there could be games where you don't even have to put one of them in, especially if you bump Aminu up to the small ball four.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is. I mean, it's frustrating. You can't just blame injuries. Every team's going to go through them, but, you know, the back end of this – you know, roster is just so incredibly horrible that injuries are really going to drag this team down, and injuries to, you know, specific players. Like I said, I think Gordon, Tyreek, even Holiday in some ways, you know, you could lose them for a stretch and still find ways to manage. But Davis and Ryan Anderson, because of what they do, are just irreplaceable. And, you know, now one of them's down again. And, you know, the drop off from Smith to whoever that other big man is going to take his 20 minutes is almost as significant as, you know, something like Eric Gordon to Anthony Morrow. I mean, it's really tough, this team dealing with injuries. And you would just love to see, you know, why can't we get the luck that Portland has just to start this year? I'd really like to know what this team would be if fully healthy. I mean, I might be an optimist, but I think it would be something like 22-10 right now. I mean, that sounds crazy, but that's only 7 wins that, you know, that were losses. And I could think of a bunch of games. I mean, the Utah game, getting embarrassed at the Lakers in Orlando. I don't think both of those happened. Both Phoenix game. I mean, there's just numerous games, the games that we lost last second against Portland, Golden State, Houston. And just it's hard for me to believe that, you know, having any kind of injury or luck, that this team's fortunes wouldn't be vastly different.
Yeah. All right, so we got 2 games coming up before what our next podcast will be. It's a back-to-back at Miami, and then they get to fly home and meet the Washington Wizards. Which team do you want to talk about, Miami or Washington?
I think I want to talk about this Miami team because I don't know if many people know about them. This team is pretty good. I mean, I'm not joking.
You're going out on a limb there.
Yeah, they could compete this year. I mean, they could be a dark horse. No, I mean, this is a team. The first thing is you got to know which team you're going to catch because, you know, every once in a while they'll do you a favor and they'll just sit one or two of their guys kind of in a San Antonio type of way. You know, they rest Wade from time to time. He's been out seven different times this year.
He doesn't play back-to-back.
Yeah, and, you know, every once in a while, I mean, LeBron got hurt the other day, missed a game. But for the most part, he plays. So does Bosch. But, I mean, they kind of mess around with teams today. They messed around with Toronto a little bit, and Toronto actually had a lead going into that fourth quarter, and then Miami pulled away. But, I mean, they're obviously led by – would you say there's a bigger, I mean, people always say LeBron than Durant, but I think as great as Durant is, I think there's as big of a gap between one and two as two and, I don't want to go too far, but maybe like 9 or 10 in the NBA. Like Durant is really good, but LeBron is just so beyond just anything that seems mortal. At this point, I mean, he's just, he's been the best player in basketball for a while, but he's even that much better this year. I mean, his field goal percentage has come down. He's only shooting about 59% now. You know, he's hitting his threes at a 40% clip, but.
Well, I mean, you could just stop right there at that field goal percentage. Michael Jordan, it was like, we're talking territory here of Michael Jordan. Like, Jordan shot, like, 52-53% in his best years. And LeBron, half the time, doesn't seem like he's even trying.
Nope.
And he's shooting almost 60% from the field. That is, like, rarefied air. Those are the types of players. The guys who shoot 60% from the field are Tyson Chandlers. Guys who all they're doing is catching and finishing as somebody else creates everything. But he is doing everything. He's taken 3.5 threes a game. I mean, yeah, I 100% agree. There isn't anybody who actually touches LeBron James right now in the NBA. You can say that Paul George is probably as good of a defensive player as him. You could say Kevin Durant is probably as good of an offensive player as him. And while I kind of nod a little bit, I still think LeBron's a better offensive player than Durant and a better defensive player than George. And George offensively is way below LeBron, and Durant defensively is way below LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, I
it's basically an A-plus guy going against a guy who's two guys who are have an A-plus and a B-plus in their respective stats.
Yeah, I don't think George. I mean, I was teaching kids the other day how to front in the low post. Honestly, the best video I found of anybody was LeBron James fronting big men. I mean, like fronting.
That's because he is a big man.
But that's what I'm saying is he could legit. I mean, there was in a series he covered Rondo, and then he could turn around and cover Pau Gasol. Or I mean, he could cover positions 1 through 5. I think he's on a different level on both sides of the court. It's just, you know, he's absolutely amazing. And this is a team that basically plays with average to below average teams, which honestly we are, and especially without Ryan Anderson, who I don't expect to be there at all on Tuesday under any circumstance. You know, they'll probably play around and toy with us for a while. And then in the fourth quarter, they just put, you know, their foot on your throat. I think the most interesting thing about this team, obviously, I mean, it's hard not to notice that Michael Beasley has been an efficient player. I mean, it's been more than a handful of games. He's played in 20 games now. He's averaging about 11 points off the bench. He's only playing 18, 19 minutes, shooting 53% from the field. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of, I always forget what his name was, at least his original name, Bryson Dele, but
right.
People probably know him better as Brian Williams, with the Bulls, just kind of a head case who came onto a loaded team, was asked to play a very specific role, and he wound up helping them win another championship. I mean, Michael Beasley goes to almost any other team this year, and he's probably already off it. But you have an absolutely loaded team with veteran leaders who ask him to do just one thing. He knows that if he slips up one time, he's gone, that they don't need him like other teams do, that they'll just throw him out. And all of a sudden, at least for a short period of time, gets his act together and is an efficient basketball player. I mean, this is just, you know, for all the people who believe in tanking, this is the anti-tanking argument here, is if you could get good, then all of a sudden you could bring in C players, you know, onto your team, and they'll play like B-plus guys. I mean, they just keep doing it again and again. And last year it was Birdman, now it's Beasley, even Rashard Lewis is giving them a little bit of a punch and getting regular minutes off the bench. I mean, really, they just have an all-world player, and everybody else just falls in line, and it's a beautiful team to watch, and it's one to definitely be envious of.
Yeah. And, I mean, and it's still the case. I think people forget about Chris Bosch, but if Bosch was on, say, Toronto still, he's still averaging 25 points a game.
And beyond that, his defense, I mean, our old friend David Thorpe did a piece not too long ago where he basically said that Bosch is one of the two or three best defensive bigs in the NBA, just that he always makes the right rotation. He's so smart. He communicates. He could play, you know, on the perimeter. He could protect the rim. I mean, yeah, his offense is still as good as ever, but apparently he's taken it to another level defensively as well.
Yeah. So, prediction for the game, how much are we losing by?
I'll go 13. I think they'll be nice to us. It's a weekday. You know, the Miami crowd won't get there until the third quarter. You know, I think we'll see some good things early, and then Miami will just decide to step on our throats and maybe come out of there with a moral victory. I'd say, yeah, I'll go Heat by 7.
I think that's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh.
I was going to say Heat by 7. I think that they're going to play around enough that the Pelicans will, you know, get out a lead, feel like they're all cool, and then get smacked.
I will say, though, this is another game. I mean, it could be back-to-back games that if Ajinka could stay on the court, if he doesn't get in crazy foul trouble, which I think
he have a big game.
He could have a big game. I mean, I'll never forget the Okafor 28-14 game against against the Heat, just because it made it look like maybe that was a good trade for us, because Okafor was able to do that, but obviously was never able to do it again. But hey, I think Ajinka could stand around the rim, you know, get a couple offensive rebounds, might have a decent game here. I don't know. I think the formula to beat the Heat is to get ahead while they're kind of playing around with you. Then when they turn it on in the fourth quarter, you get hot and make some threes to negate the inevitable run. I don't know how, you know, it could possibly manufacture that. So I don't really see a formula for any kind of crazy upset.
Yeah. So after we get to play the Heat, we fly home. The Washington Wizards come to town. Washington Wizards are 14-17. They're actually doing a back-to-back as well. So there isn't any real excuse here. The team should be equally tired coming into the game. The Wizards are an interesting team. They've got some decent defenders, but really, the way I look at the Washington Wizards is if they can make their jump shots, they win and win very well, and if they don't, they typically lose pretty badly. It's because Bradley Beal has nights where he looks like an all-star and has nights where he looks like he's terrible. And the same thing can be said for John Wall as far as his jump shot goes, because some nights he falls in love with it and he hits it. And sometimes he falls in love with it and he can't hit it. Some nights he doesn't even fall in love with it, and he's actually a lot more effective those nights, but more nights where he falls in love with it. Webster's the same sort of way. All of their perimeter guys would much rather pull up and shoot than get to the basket. So it'll be an interesting game. Gortat's not really being super effective for them. And they have their good old boy, Trevor Ariza, and we all know how good of a shooter he is. So this is one of those games where it could be really, really brutal to watch, because they're making their shots, or it could be Pelicans and a laugher. And I'm kind of leaning towards Pelicans actually being able to take this game. I don't see any way that this particular team is going to slow down Anthony Davis rolling to the rim. There isn't a single guy on this team, and Nene Hilario is their best big man, but he's not fast. He's not a quick player. As long as Drew is keeping his eyes on Anthony, I just can't see them being able to jam the pick and roll with Anthony Davis in any sort of real fashion.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I tend to agree. I mean, if I look at teams that scare me and that are bad matchups are teams that get to the rim and get to the free throw line. And this team, I mean, they're 28th and they're, basically in their free throw per field goal or attempt percentage. I don't think that this is a team that's going to be able to take advantage of what could be taken advantage of on our defense. Offensively, I mean, I agree with Davis rolling to the basket, but if you got a Jenka 18 feet out set up, or, you know, Greg Steensma, same situation, I mean, what team in the world is going to possibly respect that? How is Anthony Davis going to get lobs at the basket or even get free? I mean, if I'm the opposing coach, I just have both big men sag down every single time. They don't need Ryan Anderson, but they need, you know, some threats offensively on the floor. And
Jason Smith.
I mean, if he plays, I would feel much more confident about this game. But I mean, again, if there's no Jason Smith, no Ryan Anderson, you're looking at what, 30 to 45 minutes, maybe more. I mean, the other game it was 53 minutes of Ajinka and Steensma. I mean, that's just, I mean, combine that with the 30 to 35 minutes you're going to get of Aminu, and that means that, you know, at least half of the game you're probably going to have two black holes on the floor, if not more. I think it's going to be really tough for this team to score against almost anybody. Luckily, I think that, you know, we could hold the Wizards down as well, and this game is at home, so you're more likely to have the random good night from a Darius Miller or a Brian Roberts or Rivers or Morrow, whoever, on that night. So I would predict victory as well, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, because we're scoring on this team. I guess put it this way. I don't think anybody's getting free fries on that night.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see Davis operating in the paint, flipping around a lot more than you give him credit for. I understand what you're saying, but I don't know. That's how I feel.
Yeah.
So we'll see who's right.
I hope you are. I see something more like similar to the Boston game, something like 97-91 Pelicans.
Okay. All right. So, got anything else you wanted to chat about?
No. I guess just hopefully get word soon on Ryan Anderson.
I expect we'll get something tomorrow because that's an actual work day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because doctors are just all lounging and taking the day off. Hospital?
Yeah, but the communications people at the Pelicans maybe, you know, taking a nice weekend.
Yeah, there was actually a really nice, our Twitter account just posted up a picture of Brian Roberts, Jeff Withey, and Jason Smith Skyping with Ryan Anderson, who's in his hospital room. So, you know, it seems that he's doing better. And then, yeah, hopefully we'll get some word sometime soon. But I think that's going to be big. Like I said, this January 8th, starting then, big stretch after the two games we discussed, a home and home with Dallas, who's currently in the eighth spot in the West. I think it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks, and going to need Ryan Anderson and maybe even Jason Smith too to get back in this playoff race. Don't want to fall out of it, before the All-Star break.
Yep. So thanks everybody for listening to In the Know, and we'll be back a little later this week.